Hi, my name is Karina Harney, Playboy's Playmate of the Year, 1992.
And I'm Echo Johnson, Miss January, 1993. Welcome to the Bunny Chronicles. Let's go.
Okay, we are back in the studio in Austin. We've got Miss Kathy St. George as our co-host again. Thanks for being here, Kathy.
Hi, Echo. I'm so happy to be back. Thank you for having me.
You got it, darling. So today's going to be a fun show for you, too, because you're really good friends with Richard Ban.
Oh, I love Richard. He's such a great guy. And he's, you got to figure he's seen everything firsthand because he's been at FSI for so long, you know?
Richard was one of Hefner's closest friends and confidants of decades, but he and Hefner share their love of cinema. So Richard is a film historian, a author. Hef and Richard began and cultivated their relationship, I imagine, over their love of cinema. So we're going to get into that and the endowments that that Hefner had made to USC for the censorship in film, as well as the preservation of film. And that's a super important topic and something that we've been talking about a lot here in season two. So Richard, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more, or tell the audience a little bit more about who you are and how many years you and Hef were friends and how that all came to be.
Well, I started out as a CPA. And I got out of that as quickly as possible. I went to I became a vice president at a film company called Black Hawk Films.
Okay.
And from there, I went to New York City and was employed for 30 years by the largest producer and distributor of motion pictures and television programming in the world outside the United States, headquartered in Munich.
Okay.
And I was in New York for 10 years, and I got transferred to L.A., and one of my closest friends was Chuck McCann. And as soon as I got here, he said, "You have to meet Hugh Hefner." And I couldn't imagine I couldn't imagine how that could possibly work out. I just couldn't see that. And I was really busy at the time. And it took me, I don't know, two or three years before I finally said, well, okay, how would we do this? And I got very lucky. I made a really good connection with Hef. And in short order, he said to me, "This place is open to you 24/7.
Oh, so immediately he took a liking to you.
I had, like most people, I had no idea who this man was. All I knew was Playboy magazine.
Right.
I didn't know who he was or what he was interested in or anything. Now, what I'd like to do is after... when Hef passed, I wrote this remembrance that went out to hundreds of people, Playboy alumni and friends of mine. And there's a section in there where I talk about Hef's connection to movement. And if I go through the section that deals with this, I think that'll be the basis for. Things we can talk about with respect to Hef's interest in movies.
Great, please do.
Okay, so Hef loved movies, and he particularly loved the time travel aspect of old movies, as I do. Mm-hmm. He reached the age of reason during the depths of the Great Depression, only to discover he had just missed the Roaring Twenties, mm-hmm. as celebrated by F. Scott Fitzgerald in The Great Gatsby, a book which greatly influenced Hugh Hefner. So having missed the party, he was always looking back to try and recreate the feeling of the era he read about as a boy, mm-hmm. and longed to experience for himself. Now, growing up in the 1930s, besides his interest in pulp magazines, in pinup art, in comic books, and detective fiction, and you may know, he would reprint Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes stories in the early days of Playboy. Hef probably spent too much time seeing movies in the darkness of the Montclair Theater in Chicago. That was the sacred place where he dreamed the dreams and fantasies which inspired his lifestyle mm-hmm. and led to the creation of Playboy magazine. So up there writ large on the silver screen, he saw and he heard musicals that stirred him. And they were populated by three actresses in particular. Quote, "Those wonderful blondes from my childhood," he'd say, who he fell in love with. Toby Wing, Grace Bradley, who married William Boyd, who was Hopalong Cassidy, and his most favorite, Alice Faye. Eventually, he would meet them all, and I was there to watch it happen each time. And in 1992, my friend Ed Hulse was the chairman of our annual Cinecon Film Convention in Hollywood. And he invited Alice, because he was also a big fan of Alice Faye, he invited Alice Faye as a guest. So I shared the news with Hef, who, as you know, seldom left the sanctuary of the Playboy Mansion.
Rarely,
but it had to be something really special. But meeting Alice Faye was as special as it got for Hugh Hefner. And with a full detail of armed security officers, our friend Chuck McCann, we piled into the limousine heading for the Roosevelt Hotel, where right outside one can find Hef's star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
That's right.
Inside, Hef at last would meet Alice Faye. And each was thrilled. Wow. It was at once a love fest of mutual admiration.
Mm.
Hef behaved like the love-struck schoolboy.
How cute.
Then we screened one of her pictures for a packed house, followed by a question and answer session. And my friend Ed Hull said, "I was standing off to the side of the dais watching Hef. He sat in the front row, hanging on her every word and looking for all the world like any other smitten fanboy," end quote.
Wow.
Now, I would rather stick steel-pointed needles in my temples then face the fact that Hugh Hefner was just interred at the small, discreet Westwood Memorial Cemetery in the crypt next to Marilyn Monroe.
Right.
She was on the cover of the famous first issue of Playboy, smiling and waving.
Right.
Inside, her nude pictorial against a lush background of red velvet secured success for Hef's startup company in 1953. Yet, he never, ever met her, not once.
Really? I didn't know that.
He ran with a lot of playmates, of course, but not that many starlets and actresses. That was, as you may know, Ray Anthony's venue. And if you visit YouTube and search his name, along with Marilyn Monroe, you'll see amazing color footage of Ray and Marilyn. But it was rather Keith Hefner, not Hugh Hefner, who met Marilyn Monroe and knew her.
And Keith, and just for our audience, Keith Hefner is Hef's brother. So Keith got to meet Marilyn, and Hef never met Marilyn. Interesting.
Right. And the way that they met was they studied acting together in New York at the Actors Studio under the auspices of Lee Strasberg, who was the artistic director there.
Right.
Now, in 2006, Hef told the Los Angeles Times, quote, "I really feel in a fundamental way that American films, especially from the first half of the 20th century, are the best exponent of what we refer to as the American dream," end quote.
Mm-hmm.
The films Hef saw in his youth at the Montclair Theater shaped everything he did in his life. Casablanca was his favorite.
Yep.
And he would run it for us every year on his birthday, April 9th, which is just a few days away as we do this.
Right.
We all knew it by heart. Everyone in attendance would show up dressed in period costume for the picture.
Yeah.
And the festive event was celebrated as, quote, Casablanca Night. Now, 1 year after Hef donated yet another $1 million to the UCLA Film and Television Archive in order to support the cause of film preservation, pardon me, I told Rob Stone, as the film curator there, that a special way to thank him would be to arrange for a projection of an original 35 millimeter shimmering nitrate print on his birthday.
Excellent.
Nothing compares with seeing a nitrate print of a classic picture projected on a silver screen in a darkened theater with a respectful audience. That's all you want. That's the way to see movies.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Absolutely.
No one anywhere today, however, was without special clearance could screen dangerous, flammable nitrate prints because they have the same chemical composition as gunpowder and will burn underwater. Nitrate fires in movie history are why the industry switched to safety film stock around 1950. So this event would be once in a lifetime opportunity for HEF. So we piled into a bus. We took a bus to the UCLA campus in nearby Westwood, and the evening turned into a fantastic and unforgettable outing, though Rob remembers it was, quote, one of the most nervous, albeit gratifying, days of my life. Now, HEF felt obliged to repay the debt he believed he owed motion pictures. Mm-hmm. So starting with the Sherlock Holmes feature films, mm-hmm. he spent millions financing film preservation at UCLA, at Warner Brothers, funding academic chairs at USC, underwriting film documentaries on people like Louise Brooks, Clara Bow, Olive Thomas, Bix Beiderbecke. The last one that he did was for Alice Guy Blaché. Now, these are named probably.
Oh, actually, on that, Alice Blaché, Karina did a bunch of research on that. And not only the history of that woman, I mean, what a pioneer for her day. It was late 1800s, right? Early 1900s. Not only was she the producer, she was the director. I mean, right. she was everything. And this was the silent era. And the type of productions that she did were just way ahead of her time. And then I did know that HEF was he the executive producer on that documentary that was made about her?
I can't remember what his credit was. What I do remember is that's the last film-related donation or funding that he did, because this was right near the end of his life.
Wow, that's so interesting. I love that. And also, I know this, and we've talked about this a couple times on the podcast, that at the end of the day, HEF's, you know, idea and vision of what a Playboy Playmate is and should look like truly came from his love affair of cinema and the movie stars, the female movie stars that he loved from, you know, the early years. That's kind of what he based it on, the standard.
Yes, as I say, and those three in particular.
Yeah, in particular. Wow. That's so
to continue this, and in separate eras, he twice paid enormous sums to restore the Hollywood sign. So
right.
Who did that? Who else in Hollywood gives back that way and that much? What an example for everyone else. Now, the best times at the Playboy Mansion were not the lavish parties, the big events. For me, the best times, and the inner circle always agreed, the best times were the small gatherings for regular movie nights on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday,
right.
and Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Sundays, we'd see brand new and mostly forgettable movies, as far as I was concerned. But the rest of the time, it was old movies from all genres. And Chuck McCann used to sing out, Fridays are better than Sundays. He was right. But so-called manly night on Monday was the best of all. HEF loved romantic adventures. He loved the Flash Gordon chapter play serials. We would see those on Mondays. And he was partial to old mysteries and musicals and any version of the Frankenstein saga.
I remember that. He loved Frankenstein. He had statues of him.
Yes, he did. He liked the better Tarzan pictures. Hence, the Playboy Mansion was zoned as a zoo with a wide array of exotic birds and animals all over the 5-acre property.
Well, that's right. And that's the only residence in Los Angeles that had a zoo license.
That's right. That's right. And he was partial to mafia movies, especially The Godfather and its sequel. So we looked at those almost as much as the Charlie Chan pictures. And 20th Century Fox was his favorite movie studio. Boris Karloff and Humphrey Bogart were his two favorite actors.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the excerpt from the remembrance that I did when HEF passed.
Now, and you were the one that would write copious notes about the movies that were going to be aired, right, with the background history of everything, and then HEF would kind of break it down.
Here's how we would do this. Around 1990, when I got there, the Friday night movie was special to him. He would conduct that like it was a film class. So he would tell what the movie was, and then he would say a few things about it. And then he would say what we were going to see Saturday and what we were going to see the following week. So as he did this, because I knew a lot about old movies, I knew that he was missing certain things. Mm-hmm. So when he would tell us what the movie would be for next week, I got the idea, well, why don't I send him a fax? Now, this is 1990, so the days where you could send a fax.
Yep.
So I'd write a few paragraphs and send that to him. And it, as it developed, the notes that I would write would get very elaborate, sometimes as much as 10 pages, 10 wow. pages. So, and then during the week, he would call me. He would have, Mary would call me, hold for Hef. And we would talk about the films for the weekend, or he might call me because he knew I kept, because I worked for a European film company, that I was up all night. Mm-hmm. So he would call me at any time, 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning. We would talk about these movies. And then what he would do on Friday afternoons, he'd go into the library right by that tiger, you know, the tiger on the floor. And he would sit at that desk and he would spend the afternoon editing and rewriting my notes. So,
well, because he was the consummate editor.
Exactly. Here's the lesson I learned from that. Now, it'll surprise a lot of people to know that the inner circle of Hef's closest friends were primarily constitutional conservatives who voted for Republicans. Now, we never argued or debated with Hef about politics, but once in a while I would put in a little reference to something that was political. And then after the movie, why did you cut that? Why didn't you use that? And he would say to me, every writer needs a good editor. that's a lesson I learned.
Richard, I just, let me cut in a second. I remember being at the movie on a Friday night. And that's when Echo brought it up. I remembered one of my favorite parts was when he would read to us what the movie was about and just things about it before the film started. And right. It was Alfred Hitchcock with Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman. And I remember him, and I've never forgotten this, him telling us that if we notice in the film, the on-screen kiss only lasts 39 seconds because they're not allowed to kiss longer or it's considered racy.
Wow.
So they would have to stop the kiss and then they could start a kiss again.
That's right.
But they, and I just never forgot that information. You know,
I mean, he knew every finite detail about everything.
It was so much fun. And he always had a Warner Brothers cartoon.
Those were the best. The movie nights were absolutely the best. I love that. Is it true that so the media room that was housed in the library that would show the movies, I think it was Andy Schwab who I spoke to. Didn't Hef use like an old school projector or I don't even know if projector is the right word for it, but it was a certain type of.
Yes, Hef wanted to be true to the medium.
Right.
Now, what you would see in movie theaters, I'm older than you guys, but you would see 35 millimeter films projected. As I said in what I wrote, originally they were flammable nitrate films. And in 1950, they had to change the standard to safety film. So it was 35 millimeters. So on Sunday, you probably remember we'd see new movies. And someone from the studio, for purposes of safeguarding against film piracy, someone from the studio would sit there while the print was being projected in 35 millimeter. Eventually, with the development of a videotape, of Beta, of VHS, of laser discs, and then ultimately DVDs and now Blu-rays and high definition, Heff would always upgrade everything that he had in his library. You remember also, if you went out to the tennis court by the wishing well, you'd see all those satellites up behind that area.
That's
and
right.
It was for the purpose of pulling in movies that were being shown on cable TV all over the world, so that Heff was constantly upgrading that library, getting better quality prints to show. And whatever the latest medium that they were being offered on, he wanted that.
That makes sense. But that's actually also surprising, because we all know that, you know, at the end of the day, that Heff was, he was a creature of habit. And, you know, at points it was hard for him to change things or evolve. Like for me, I always think about when the internet, you know, came on board, and he, you know, it took him a couple of years to like wrap his head around it and understand that, like, hey, this is here to stay, and we do need to incorporate this into the company.
I share that with that idea as far as that goes. I resist change as well. I don't use a cell phone. Heff never used a cell phone. He never used a computer either. Of course, and as you know, all of his life, he was afraid to talk on the telephone. He'd sit on the floor in Mary's office and tell her who to call and what to say.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, my God. But that makes sense, because it's true.
I mean, if you ever went into Mary's office, there was a chair that was, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 inches off the floor. And he would sit on that and look up at Mary at her desk. And he would run the Playboy empire.
Dictating to Mary O'Connor. I love it.
But from the floor.
Yeah. That's
like
awesome.
A little boy.
He always was a little boy. He was always trying on being the boy who dreamed the dreams.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I know. Absolutely.
He was Peter Pan. He didn't have the syndrome.
He was. syndrome. I love it.
He was Peter Pan.
I love getting these little candid outtakes from all of these interviews, and every single interview we pull out this little golden nugget of history or a factoid, and it's just always like amazing and interesting to hear. And also,
can you imagine, this man was afraid. He was uncomfortable talking on the phone, but when he had to talk to me late at night, there was no one around to place the call for him, so he would call.
He's like, damn it, I got to use the phone and call Richard.
He must love you, Richard.
Well, he would do the same thing with, when The Girls Next Door started, he would do the same thing with Kevin Burns. So Kevin and I would talk about the fact, you know, if either one of us had an interesting conversation with Heff, because Kevin lived very close to where I am in Beverly Hills. And, you know, we would talk about whatever crazy thing Heff might do or say on the phone that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So actually, that's a good segue into The Girls Next Door. So obviously, you were there when and knew Kimberly Hefner very well. So you were there when Heff was married, and it was the family home and the babies and the boys. And then to witness the transition from, you know, becoming single again.
I wasn't.
And then bringing on multiple girlfriends, which at the beginning, Mandy, Brandy, and Sandy were my absolute favorites. I love those girls so very much. I always forget about Jessica. It was always Mandy, Brandy, and Sandy. But so you were there then when it was Holly, Bridget, and Kendra, and got to, you know, firsthand witness to all of that. What was your take on that when he started taking on multiple girlfriends? I mean, even up to 7 at a time, but specifically that threesome and watching that.
Well, I remember when he and Kimberly separated, there was that, I think it was a New Year's Eve party, and Kimberly didn't attend.
Mm-hmm.
Took the boys skiing or something.
Mm-hmm.
And Hef felt like he'd been shown up. And that was the first sign that there's real trouble here. And he was a little depressed, but he would never let on that he was upset. There were times, I remember I said to him during a downtime like that at one of the big parties that I tried to let him know, you know, your friends are here for you. We're on your side. We know this is a tough thing for you. But he would never give in to admitting that. He would say,
no.
He would say to me, what are you talking about? I'm in the best place of my life right now.
Anyone that can show Runaway Bride the day his wife cancels the wedding.
Oh, yes.
Has a sense of humor.
Yeah, great sense of
and
humor.
And just go through it like
But he said he was surprised to learn, and this was the phrase you heard all the time, that people were, girls especially, were waiting for him to come out and play.
That's right. So
to help him, originally it was Mark Saginaw, Doc Saginaw, and I who went out with him to these clubs, but that was never a scene that I was comfortable in. So I didn't last very long in that. And then he invited Joel and Allison.
Right.
And Allison was really good. In other words, if Hef wanted to do something with whatever girls he was partying with that night, he talked to Allison and let her talk to them about whatever it was that he wanted to see happen. So she was really good helping Hef, because he was really shy, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
I swear he was so shy.
Really?
I mean, when I hear about all this stuff on TV and all this stuff, I go, this is not the man that I knew.
No.
This is, I mean, he was and such a gentleman about any of it.
Well, Kathy, what you just mentioned could apply to that A&E documentary. And I know at some point here we want to talk about that. Mm-hmm. That's not the man that we knew.
No. Not at all.
I want to come back to that point, Richard, of what you said, that he was absolutely in awe the reception that he received when he came out of the mansion. And I remember the first night that he came out, we were doing a Playboy fashion show at a club in Hollywood. And Barbara Moore was in the fashion show, and I was there with Jamie Bergman, and he had seen us, and he invited us over to sit at the table. So we were sitting right up at the front. And the crowd was going wild. They're like, oh, my God, Hugh Hefner is here. So Barbara comes walking down the runway and then proceeds to get on all fours and crawl towards him. And he put his hand out and she sucked his finger and he just loved it. He was so happy. But everybody was so happy that, like, oh, my gosh, like, we get this chance to see, like, half out and about. And then all the parties started happening again. And it was a really special time. Because
didn't he go right after Jamie Bergman right there?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I was there the night that Jamie was up at the mansion, and he was one
of the first ones that he went after.
Yeah, whether or not they did anything, I don't know, but I do know that he absolutely adored her, and hence the reason why she became Playmate of. Well, she wasn't Playmate of the Year because she had gotten the show Son of a Beach, but he went ahead and put her on the cover. But yeah, he absolutely adored her.
Right.
But he didn't give Playmate of the Year to people he adored. Trust me. I know they had to earn it.
They had to earn it.
Yeah. Because I know girls that he did like, and he even... I have spoken to him on the phone, Dick, Richard, because you called me and I spoke to him on the phone once.
I don't remember that.
And it was concerning a girl that he thought would be a good Playmate of the Year, wanted my opinion about some things. And we'll talk about it, but it was, and And I had a nice conversation with him. Oh my God. And I lived at the apartment, you know, by where you and I lived near each other. We used to walk around.
Yep.
And he spoke to me, and that's it. But you were on the phone practically holding it.
How about that?
And at the end of the day, Kathy, I think you swayed him in the other direction and somebody else got PMOY, right?
No, I didn't. I actually swayed him in her direction.
Well, lucky her. So who was it? Who was it?
But it didn't happen. But I spoke very well of the situation and because he really liked her. I remember he liked her so much that one time I stayed at the mansion because Joni always used to give me a ride home if I wanted to drink that night. And I don't like to drink and drive. So Joni would give me a lift home. And she goes, why don't you just stay in bedroom 4 and get some sun tomorrow and blah, blah. So I said, okay. So I stayed in bedroom 4, but I woke up with a hangover. And I
went to the bar,
ordered a Bloody Mary. into my room, and I went down to the jacuzzi, and I was in the jacuzzi with a glass, and I remember it was the first time I met Brandy. She came over with some friends who I adore like crazy.
She was in the she was in the grotto, right? And you went and sat with
them? She went into the grotto. It was just a day. Nobody was out there. It was just the girls. But Hef came down. And he scolded me for my glass.
Whose glass is this?
And I said, I'm a naughty girl. But when we walked out, he said to me, I finally got a chance to be with that person I've liked for a really long time that I told you about. And I said, really? I'm so happy for you. He's just like us. He worries about the same stuff. And he said, I just hope she remembers me.
I'm so sure like some woman's going to be like, oh, I don't remember sleeping with Hugh Hefner.
Been there, done that.
now, Kathy, you mentioned a couple of things that reminded me of two things that I'll mention. And Echo, you could cut this out. You mentioned Joni Mattis. Now, she was a panic. She was an absolute panic. She was the playmate who showed the least amount of skin in the history of Playboy.
I know.
But she was totally devoted to Hef. And I remember more than once there would be somebody on the property and she would walk right up to whoever the girl was. And, you know, Joni had that maniacal laugh. And when she laughed, she'd flip that hair back with her hand, and she would say to some girl, "How did you get in here?"
I know.
How did you get in here? You're coming with me right now. And she'd take her out, you know, and they would have to either call a cab or if she had a car on the property, she'd have to leave.
Escort them off because they were not of the caliber.
How did you get in here? I saw that happen.
She took such good care of me. I used to go up because I lived so close that a lot of times I'd go up on Monopoly night and I would hang out in the library. But I would come up not in makeup or anything. I would come up in my pajamas, but not cute pajamas. We're talking, and Hef would be playing Monopoly, and Joni would be there, and she'd order me a BLT with avocado. And I just had this thing with Joni. I loved her so much. And I would lay on the couch, and sometimes I'd fall asleep, and Hef would have him put a blanket over me.
Aww, because he would always take care of us girls. That's right.
And he always made sure we had my doll, because God forbid we all synced up and were PMSing at the same time.
Hey, so speaking of Joni going up to women and asking how the hell did you get in here? too bad she wasn't there when Holly showed up for the first time.
Because
we all know Holly did not look like she looks now when she came up for the first time.
And even then.
No, she did not.
No, she was a good guard dog in a way. You know what I mean? She's like, took care of everybody.
So Richard, you were there, as we were saying, the entire time that The Girls Next Door was being filmed. And we all know that Holly absolutely loved Hef and adored him. And that's everything that we saw, you know, personally, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, at the end of the day, when they're when they separated and their relationship came apart, and then she went on to Vegas and had her own burlesque show for 8 years, and then she wrote that book. What was your opinion on that? I mean, everybody had to be so confused because it totally went against the grain of like everything that we saw.
No,
she ran out of money, is what it is.
I heard about the book. I happened to be having lunch with somebody on Sunset Plaza, and I walked down to Book Soup because I wanted to take a look at this book. I thought I was going to buy it. I picked up Holly's book. I spent about 5 minutes sampling certain sections. I put the book down, and I felt like I needed to wash my hands.
Wow, that's a statement.
I was shocked. And, you know, I was on Holly's side for so long. I thought a lot of her.
Yeah, we all did. I loved her when I met her. I thought she was wonderful.
She had invested all those years. She tried to give Hef a child. She wanted to marry him. He said he couldn't do that because he was then married, but he could have divorced because yes. He did subsequently. And at that point, I could see Holly was out of moves. She had to leave. That made sense to me. Okay, I thought. But then her reinvention disappointed so many of us, and in fact, all of us, as far as I can tell. That made no sense to me. I will never understand why she turned on people who did so much for her. And Ray Anthony and I remember so well, you know, Ray Anthony's now 101 years old, but he and I were sitting together on one of the Fun in the Sun tryouts. That's what they were. They were tryouts, really. And first, she tried to get noticed for 6 months there while she was working at Hooters.
Right.
And I remember one conversation in particular we had with her. And I know from both Hef and Dr. Sagner what she did to finally break through. After 6 months of failing to get anywhere, get noticed. And I wonder what would happen today in a debate between Renee Baio and Holly.
Oh, I would like to see that one because Renee calls it straight.
Yes, she does. But Holly's too smart to ever allow that to happen. But I will say this. I'll bet the ranch that if Hef would have married Holly, they both would have lived happily ever after. Mm-hmm. And this other side, this other narrative would never have come out. As it is, I think the subtext for her position now, though she won't say so, is that she will spend the rest of her life trying to get even with Hef for not marrying her. But for both of their sakes, that's what should have happened. None of this trouble would have surfaced.
Mm-hmm. I know. It's very sad because I agree with you. I agree she loved him like crazy. And I agree that she was just brokenhearted and it damaged her.
Kathy, were you ever there when her family would visit?
You know, I'm going to be honest. I was living a lot. I was not going up as much. I did go up to the mansion, but not as much on the movie night as I did once. Because I don't know why particularly, because I loved it up there. But I do know that Ava was her assistant. So, you know, Ava Fabian was her assistant. So I, you know, met her through that. And I went up to a couple parties and met, the other girls. But I never sat and had a conversation with her. No.
Well, I mentioned her family once, I don't know, 3 or 4 times, her parents, her brother and her sister would come to the Playboy Mansion. And they seemed like the perfect all-American family. And I'd look at the sister, then over to Holly Madison. That isn't even her real name. And I think, oh, that's what Holly is supposed to look like. And it's sad when you realize that Holly was top to bottom
redone.
Beverly Hills Science Project. And before Kevin Burns passed, because he was always, he would not hold back when he'd talk about complaining about Holly. And I would say to him several times that in every photo I'd see of Holly, she looked better than ever. She looked absolutely beautiful, really beautiful, I thought. And he'd scoff and say, best face money can buy.
But it was, you know what, though? It was well spent.
Yeah, because
I'll tell you,
she looked great, but she didn't look anything like her sister.
No,
the sister, the hair, the body, the nose.
I saw early pictures of Holly in it. She didn't look like, you know.
Well, good for her that she was able to do that. And yeah,
Because I'll tell you, you can get a really bad surgeon in that town.
The only thing for me is she looks dead in the eyes in any interview. Like, there's no emotion that comes out of her. It's strange, but anyway.
I think there's a part of her that will love Hef,
of course,
forever, and the rest of it is just sort of existence. You know, it's like she.
Well,
I'm sorry Hef was afraid at that time or dealing with so much stuff with, you know, and he was still married, by the way, that puts a lot of fear. But I'm really sorry it didn't work out because her bitterness went so far beyond anything I could imagine.
Why did she have to do that? What?
I don't even know.
What did that get her? Except the enmity of all Playboy Mansion alumni.
I mean, my boyfriend broke up with me in a text, and I'm still good friends with him.
I mean, at the end of the day, I feel like it's just for her to remain relevant, and she knows that attaching her name to Playboy and to Hefner will create revenue for her, and that's what she's doing. And for her to have the like deep dark desire to ruin his legacy, there's something wrong there with her brain. Like, that is just like, why would you do that? It makes no sense, but whatever. I don't want to just
and that goes on now to other people that are doing that. I mean, I'm not trying to segue too much, but I'm just saying other people that are getting their 15 minutes in their elder years or what, that are suddenly using Hugh Hefner as a means to get that attention.
Well, yeah, but at the end of the day, how many of them are there? There's five of them, and then there's this collective group of hundreds and hundreds of Playmates and the Playboy family and the friends and, you know, all of us are saying the same thing. So I do think that people are seeing through the bullshit that is that docuseries.
Yeah, there's going to be a season two.
There's not, because Alexander Dean can't get anybody to come on board because she realized that she's lying and there's this fake narrative and we're not going to go along with it.
And when she had Allison Reynolds on, who to me is one of the best. I mean, I love Allison. I love Allison as she was my makeup artist, as a person. She's married to one of my best friends who I knew before she even met him. He was a best friend in New York, and they have been married for a zillion years. The thing is, Allison, I respect her opinion and the way she does things and how her love for Hef.
Right.
And the fact is, they did not even put her interview really on because
they spent 48
things.
They spent 48 hours at her home and she had 1 minute on the docuseries. Well, same thing with you too, Richard. You had like a blip and so did Leon. I mean, it was ridiculous.
And you were like his twin from a separate mother.
you want to hear this review?
Yes, please.
Okay. So some thoughts on the first, this is what I wrote. Some thoughts on the first few installments of this A&E atrocity, this travesty, this attempted assassination of a great man, Hugh M. Hefner. What an ugly turn of events. Such trash can't disappear soon enough. They chased me to do an interview. I kept asking what
me this too.
was. Never got a clear answer. The production team wouldn't show their hand, but they said they wanted to talk to insiders to tell the real story, the truth about Mr. Hefner and Playboy. I told them the truth. Based on what I've seen on the air so far, however, they only allowed me and others to say what wasn't contrary to their now revealed agenda, a one-sided Me Too hit piece, a completely fraudulent, fake, and unfounded conflating of Hef with the disgraced Messrs. Weinstein and Cosby. Clearly, this is a false equivalency, which either they don't know or they don't care. Viewers, by what they see, are being conned. And so A&E let a fringe handful of ingrates burp up nonsense, peddling victimhood to make fools out of the mostly cancel culture, woke women on the radical left who produced this sad, ill-conceived calamity. They rented an Airbnb and sent a car for a 9 a.m. interview call. They drove me home in the dark. My session was conducted early on before anyone knew what they planned. There was a big crew, all women, all smiling, all nice. They gave me no reason not to believe the thing was going to be a positive portrayal of this man, just like all the many previous documentaries on Hef, including one produced by a woman, Bridget Berman. The producers had read the remembrance piece I wrote after Hef passed and concluded I could offer psychological insight into who he was and how he got that way, which I explained for them all day long. In the end, however, they would only pick and choose comments to excerpt out of context. Months later, I saw the trailer and the press release and realized what their real agenda was, a Machiavellian takedown of a powerful man by a group of woefully woke women who must dislike men and who targeted the one man who personifies all the things that they hate the most. To do this, they were going to search through the thousands of Playboy Nation women who have crossed paths with Hef in order to locate the approximately 5 damaged souls who, when telling their salacious stories, have now revealed themselves to be ingrates capable of heinous accusations in search of extending their sorry 15 minutes of notoriety. That's what we have here. Honestly, I think I lose brain cells listening to them. One would have to drink a big cup of stupid to believe these people. But they're all strictly on the level, aren't they? Yes, they are, like a flight of stairs. Mm-hmm. In their rush to judgment, what A&E offers us are a lot of suspicious charges and conclusions in search of evidence, a complete distortion. The whole thing seems to be an exercise in mental masturbation for dysfunctional people on both sides of the camera. Has it somehow escaped the vigilance of A&E that for each of these 5 complainants, we could produce scores of actually credible witnesses who would rebut the sleazy testimony of these few professional victims who can only remember events the way they want and need to? The shrieking chorus produces no evidence for any of their bitter nonsense. So wouldn't a journalistic integrity demand weighing the preponderance of testimony offered to A&E? But that's not what we get. The multitudinous men and women who would offer differing testimonies, and those who did offer testimony in contravention of these few women, you won't be hearing from them on A&E's wildly one-sided docuseries. No, because the lunatic fringe is the majority on A&E's glittering jewel of colossal bias and unfairness.
Oh my.
500 people actually knew and loved the man, maybe even 5,000. Have only wonderful memories and praise for Hugh Hefner, but a mere 5 or so surface who don't. Let's make our own tabloid TV show about these few miscreants. Let's tear down.
Because they know. Icon. They know.
Wait, hold on. He's not done reading.
I'm sorry.
let's tear down another Rikon, because celebrity bashing always sells, right? I think complete neurological workups for each of these gold-plated hypocrites is probably in order. They seem to be suddenly looking for injustice everywhere except in their own behavior. Wallowing in their victimhood and unearned moral superiority, these unguided missiles have clearly been vaccinated against the truth. Yet A&E doesn't seem to be concerned. Why? Slinging mud makes for news, regardless of the facts and the truth. Hugh Hefner's not here to defend himself. Makes no difference to A&E. All the better, in fact, makes him an easy target. Now, the star of the first episode is a woman who is incredibly betraying and trying to destroy her own physician father, who was Hef's close friend. She does so in a vicious, disgusting way based on her book. Long ago, when it was first published, everyone on the Playboy scene laughed at it, dismissing such a smear campaign as fallacious fiction and the product of some kind of delusional disorder. One could grow roses with the stuff she wrote. Is annoying people her life's work? With the distorted prism through which these soulless robots see the world, it is, I guess, a crime for men to like women, to want to date and get somewhere with women. It is a fact of life in general. Women do not understand male sexuality and vice versa. I recall several conversations with Hef when Playboy magazine featured an enlightening, even transformative article called "It's All in the Genes." This revolutionary piece explained clearly for each side to discover how we all got here, the differences in male and female sexuality that are seldom explained. Throughout world history, surprise, men are driven to pursue women, often for reasons that women cannot understand. I like what former Playmate of the Year Brandi Roderick said, rallying to Hef's defense for some interview show. You won't hear this opposing point of view on A&E because it doesn't fit their twisted narrative. Quote, "They're talking about men preying on these young girls," she rightfully scoffed. "How about the girls preying on these rich men?" End quote. The late Dick Stewart and Ann Randall were as close to Hef as anyone, ever, dating back to 1972. Ann Randall laments, "It is sad to see his girlfriends malign him. He was so good to them, and he really loved them," end quote. Corina Harney is a playmate who is also a practicing Christian. She says, quote, "What I've seen so far at A&E are vicious, bitter tales. I spoke to a producer with A&E who was trying to dig up dirt and not really listening to me. She mentioned people I knew and loved and spent time with and had her own opinions and was not objective. She does not know any of these people. She does not realize the Playboy family is an organization of decent, loyal, kind human beings. So I know what these women are doing. They're canceling Hef. They are praising themselves, clear iconoclastic arrogance," end quote. Allison Reynolds correctly points out, "The people doing this documentary never met Hugh Hefner. They are merely using his name to further their own careers. They will carry the shame of this documentary through the rest of their lives," end quote. Jerry Vale's wife, Rita, speaks for so many others I could quote. "If these girls were so unhappy, why did they stay for so many years? No one held a gun to their heads. They were paid, lived rent-free with hairdressers, wardrobe people to assist them, and given many presents, cars, jewelry, clothes. They all had aspirations either to become centerfolds, movie actresses, or marry some rich or famous person." Now that Hef is not here to defend himself, they come out of the dark like rats, end quote. Vincent Bugliosi's wife, Gail, who knows something about journalism and the law, concludes, quote, "This is one of the most irresponsible journalism jobs I have ever seen," end quote. And if you haven't seen the statement issued by Renee Bale, Scott's wife, please go find it on social media. Reads almost like therapy for some of us. She holds nothing back, as in pow, right between the eyes. Of their own free will, their choice, these ladies, you should pardon the expression, these ladies were ready to sell their souls to get into Playboy, to leverage a connection with Hugh Hefner, to grab their moment in the spotlight and to cash in. With cash, the elusive spondulics being the operative word. Some begged for it, that treasured admittance to the Playboy mansion. Where would any of them be today without Hugh Hefner? Hef's biographer, Dr. Stephen Watts, offers this critique, quote, "To present on television an account of Hef's life that consists of an unrelenting, even vicious series of attacks from four or five people only, where facts and evidence are in short supply, and where his good qualities and important achievements, for which you could find 400 or 500 witnesses, are barely mentioned, gives viewers an incredibly distorted portrait of the man. In my opinion, it is the worst kind of sleazy tabloid journalism. I did not see the man I knew, but instead a cartoonish villain," end quote. Hundreds of witnesses did indeed come forward, affixing their signatures to a document now published and widely circulated by People magazine, denouncing the unfounded and outlandish allegations in A&E's series. Married to Hef for 21 years, Kimberly Hefner contributed this statement, quote, "All people should be encouraged to share their individual experiences, but no one should be emboldened to rewrite the truth at the expense of another person's character. What the alleges who speak out now seem to ignore is that there were many of us throughout the years who were there with them as well. I'm sad mostly that these accounts take light away from true victims of sexual abuse and hope that in time, those selling lies to defame Hef will find peace within their own lives," end quote. Cornered about the People story and the avalanche of complaints across social media, an A&E representative could only sputter that their featured accusers deserve to share their stories and their truth. They are stories. So they got that part of it. As for their truth, what about the truth? The objective truth, the actual truth. Is there any interest in that? No. Cooper Hefner nails it as a case where regret becomes revenge for these women. Their hateful testimony on A&E tells us more about who and what they are than about Hugh Hefner, who never hid anything about who he was, what he did, and why. How many times did he declare, smiling for public consumption, quote, "My life is an open book with pictures"? Cooper also says, however unconventional, he was sincere in his approach and lived honestly, end quote. His son's statement reminded me of something relevant that Hef said in the solid Playboy documentary made by David Lynch titled Hugh Hefner Once Upon a Time, quote, "Could I honestly say to myself, that in all those years, with all those adventures, what for me was a celebration of my life, could I say with certainty that someone wasn't hurt by it? No, I couldn't say that with certainty. I didn't know," end quote. Meanwhile, where is the Playboy Foundation through all this? Will they take some kind of an action, at least issue a statement? As for the new owners of Playboy, they're worse than A&E. One good thing has come out of this fiasco. I've been reconnecting with many Playboy alumni about this show. This exchange was typical, the one I had on the phone with another Playmate of the Year, Heather Kozar. It brought tears to learn how a few disgruntled women were betraying a man so many still cherish. Yet another Playboy of the Year said to me privately, quote, "I'm disgusted. The clips of interviews make me want to vomit." I spoke with Kendra Wilkinson, always a great supporter of Hef. She said all this makes her sad and that she is proud of Hef's legion of friends who are fighting for him. But right now, as a single mom, she is focused exclusively on her new career and her two kids. I told her that I respect her decision to stay out of the fray. The late Kevin Burns made several exceptional documentaries on Hef. He also produced the Girls Next Door series. So far, there is no mention of his name on A&E. With his connections at all these cable networks, I wonder if Heaven could have killed what A&E was doing. he would frequently excoriate one of the three Girls Next Door stars, certainly not Kendra, as only he could do. It was search and destroy time. I saw that many times. But more than once, I would mention how great she now looks in all the photos that I'd see. And she does look beautiful on A&E series. Quote, best face money can buy, he would respond with some degree of scorn. Kevin was right, a Beverly Hills science project, he would say. And she had us all fooled, same as she did the A&E crowd. Is there such a thing as plastic surgery for the inside, for one's heart and soul? For the longest time, I was on her side, too. I always liked her, thought we were friends. A&E uses a nice photo of the two of us, but she really disappointed me. All those years, I thought she was terrific. I'm truly saddened to see the way she turned on someone who gave her everything, from a waitress to Hooters to an alleged net worth of $16 million. I guess she's a self-made woman, of course, with no help from Hef, and one who now worships her creator. Again, she had us all fooled. Evidently, all these years, the Motion Picture Academy of Arts and Sciences has been awarding Oscars to the wrong actresses. Of the once beautiful senior member of the group of ingrates celebrated by A&E, no one can understand why she has taken a giant leap from her senses and turned on Hugh Hefner after all this time. Watching her abusive denunciation of Hef as the pain receptors went off in his brain, one member of the inner circle was moved to remark, quote, I can't help but think that maybe now she has the face she deserves, and I don't feel sorry for her. When Hef passed, I wrote a remembrance to circulate on social media. I gave it to the A&E producer. I know that she knew what the truth was about this man. Too many of us told her, in particular, Leon Isaac Kennedy, Allison Reynolds, Joel Berliner, and certain playmates who have not been excerpted so far. Since they loved Hef, maybe we won't be seeing them at all. And why not? Because the producers have chosen to focus instead on this tiny conga line of crying kooks, all virtue signaling, but who couldn't likely pass a lie detector test to save their lives. Where is Perry Mason when we need him? What A&E does here reinforces a lesson learned long ago. The few times I've been on the inside of some national news story, I have seen how the media totally screws it up. Some source racing to get the story out breaks the news first. Then other media outlets simply copy it, full of guesses and untruths. Once you witness this, the experience begs the question, why should I? Why would I believe anything I read or see in the news or on television? Why would I do that? Nearing the end of production, the producer sent some of us registered letters detailing ridiculous charges, absent any evidence whatsoever, and offering us a chance to rebut them. Here was my response. Dear Alexandra, everything I told you in our recorded Q&A about Hugh Hefner was positive and reflects my 30 years at the Playboy Mansion, seeing the man 4 or 5 nights a week. I can only speak for myself, what I observed, what I heard. What goes on in someone's bedroom is private and not for discussing. I won't be discussing it here. Most of what I read in the letter, I would not dignify with comment either in published print or on camera. If some of those things were true, why didn't the parties making such laughable charges today do or say something about them when they happened? If they happened, is there any proof, corroboration, confirmation? Think carefully. Don't be caught rolling around in the dirt with such damaged souls. Word is getting around. People I know, lots of people, are appalled that your group would seriously entertain such nonsense. Those making the charges you relate, it should tell you more about them than about Hugh Hefner. If you were there and met these people, those people in interviews, consider the source. It is unfortunate you never met Hugh Hefner, even for just a few minutes. This exchange would not be necessary. So no, I would not care to respond on the record to those likely suffering from a vestigial memory or those of such feeble mentality who edit their own reality to elevate themselves at the expense of someone else or to satisfy some pathological disorder. The lesson for them should be, blessed is the man or the woman who, having nothing to say, abstains from giving wordy evidence of that fact. You made a serious documentary about Hedy Lamarr. Therefore, I feel certain you do not care to be associated with the kind of alleged journalism with wild charges found in tabloids on newsstands like the National Enquirer. Do you? Do you? That is my comment off the record. I look forward to a balanced documentary, one you can be proud of. It goes without saying, but I will say anyway, there was nothing, and I mean nothing, fair and or balanced about the "if it bleeds, it leads" hit piece, press release, or video promo you have circulated. Regards, Richard W. Bam.
Oh, bravo. My God, that is bravo. Incredible. Richard, thank you.
Covered it all.
Thank you for sharing that. Thank you for the eloquence in which you spoke and addressed every single detail. I have tears right now. Thank you for doing that. That is one of the most incredible statements I've ever heard.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
You remind me of something. When I wrote the remembrance that I excerpted to talk about Hef's connection to movies, it was only a part of what I wrote. And as I say, I circulated that on social media and to hundreds of Playboy Mansion alumni and other friends. And the response that I got really touched me. Here's the response I got from Playmates. Certain Playmates said to me, "I can't stop reading this. This reminds me of so many things in my life that were so important to me, my connection to Playboy, to Hugh Hefner, all the great times we had. I can't stop reading this." And then other Playmates said to me, "I can't finish this. I break down reading this. I can't read it." I mean,
you had
the dichotomy of some Playmates. They're both different groups of Playmates were really touched by summoning in their own minds what they remembered about Playboy and Hugh Hefner, that they couldn't deal with it and they had to put it down. And then other Playmates, they couldn't stop reading it. I knew I'd touched something and I was
just
glad that.
Thank you for writing that.
Thank you. Yes.
It was very touching.
That is powerful. And that is, I mean, everything. Did Alexander Dean respond to you?
Oh, no, no response to that. No response to that. Now, you can, as I said at the outset, when I first talked to The Rock and went through the gate and met Hugh Hefner, I really had no idea who this man was. I just knew all I knew was Playboy magazine. Okay. So,
right.
So the great unwashed masses out there watching this docuseries, that's all they know as well. They don't know who he was. So, whatever it was, 12 hours of continual disparaging, hateful remarks about Hugh Hefner, a lot of people are going to be persuaded, And they don't hear the other side. They don't know what we know. They weren't there. We were there. We do know the truth.
That's right.
And unfortunately, people are not going to know. Now, Leon Isaac Kennedy has been working on putting together some kind of a, I don't know what it is, a documentary. And
right.
And so I hope that eventually will come out and gain an audience so that people can see what the other side is.
Well, it will. And I'm so grateful to Leon for doing that. And as I told you, Karina and I were a part of that. We were also there the day that Renee Bio was there. And my jaw hit the floor when I heard her interview and the things that she was saying. I mean,
she nails it.
So, it was very necessary that something was done in response to that. And I applaud Leon for doing this. And I cannot wait for it to come out. And it will be well received. It absolutely will.
Good.
Wow. That took my breath away.
You know, Richard, I lived with Sandra Theodore in the 80 and 81.
And, oh, you did?
Oh, yes. I lived with Sandra and Kelly Tuff.
Oh, wow.
And so I remember Max, the dog, and I remember, and I also remember, let's just say that none of those complaints were ever made at home. The dog was never brought home when she had the night off. Therefore, she had no fear of leaving the dog at the mansion.
Right.
And I also knew who her supplier was. So the fact is, Hef had no knowledge of a lot of things.
Yeah.
So I don't want to say, I mean, I love Sandra, but I'm just saying it hurt, you know, that Kelly Tuff was actually wrote things on Facebook disputing the interview and was removed from Facebook.
Really?
Yes. It took her a few months to get back on Facebook because she disputed the things that were being said by her best friend and roommate, because Kelly lived at the mansion too most of the time. That's I had the apartment by myself most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So I'm just saying, I was privy to. That's why I'm more shocked than anyone, because I knew this person, and she was happy as a clam.
Right.
At the time I knew her.
Right.
And there was never complaints of any kind.
Right.
They're all rewriting history the way they need to see it for themselves to make sense out of mistakes that they made in their lives or pathological disorders
and she does not mention that she met her husband in Hef's bedroom.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, too, what you said, Richard, and I had already called this out, and I said this to Alexandra Dean, and then Sarah Moshman was another producer on the show that called me a second time. I was like, well, we're doing a second series and da da da. And I played dumb and I was like, oh yeah, I want to be involved, and heard her out. And then when she was done talking, I said, look, we all know exactly what you're up to. It's disgusting. It's wrong. It's absolute lies. And what you guys are doing is taking this opportunity in the cancel culture movement and attaching Hugh Hefner to the Me Too movement because you assume he is this sexual predator. And it is all false and it is disgusting and it will come back in your face in some regard, one way or another. And as you said, Alexandra Dean was considered an incredible journalist. And by her doing this, she, in my opinion, has ruined her career.
Saved. Well, so, you know, we saw the documentary. Hef ran it for us the last year of his life.
The Hedy Lamarr story?
Hedy Lamarr, yeah.
Yeah, we all loved it. That's why I wanted to talk to her. That's what we all said. We're like, oh yeah, I loved what you did. And then she did this, and oh my God. Yeah,
Well, she contacted me, and it was when I was moving to Florida and closing up shop in LA. So I just said, I'm very busy right now. I still have her number. And the fact is, when all this started coming out, now I didn't watch it, but people started contacting me because they used photos of me, like I was one of the people that was disturbed with Hef. And they had me in an episode, and I was like, no, I have no problem. Why are they using my picture? Mm-hmm. And I contacted her after that, and I didn't say a word. I just said, are you going to be shooting any more episodes? And I'm sorry to say, I didn't say anything about it. She said, yes, we'll be shooting season 2. And I said, oh, keep me posted, because I want to go in and punch her in the face.
Right. Same.
Because I'm a New Yorker, too.
Well, I can guarantee you there's not going to be a season 2, because they can't get anybody else to come on, because we're all on the same page of like, no, this is all lies.
I've just seen Sandra. Sandra had been to my apartment like a year before I left LA, which was 2014. I mean, 2000, sorry. It was after my break. So it was 2019. And she came over and played the piano and sang in the lobby of my apartment building. And everyone in the building was saying, oh my God, what's that beautiful music I'm hearing? And I went down, it was Sandra.
Yeah.
But this was before this ever happened, you know, and she was there visiting Sis. So, but the thing is, I was very shocked by it all, because it was, number one, I was there. I lived with her. This was the period of time. I probably was up there 24/7. You know, I was on a 24-hour list too. And
Hef was not providing cocaine, nor did he do cocaine.
Never. In fact, he would ask us, please don't. And if you do, please make sure that you don't drop it on the floor, because we have a dog here addicted to cocaine. Louie, remember Louie, Dante's dog?
No, I don't. I remember John Dante. I don't remember the dog.
He passed on before you got there.
The but dog addicted to cocaine.
You know, he had his wonderful assistant, Bobby Arnstein, deal with all that stuff. He did not want drugs in his house.
No.
He knew there was no way to keep drugs out of his house, but he did not supply drugs.
Here's the proof of that from my standpoint. One of Hef's dearest, closest friends, and I'm not going to name him, but there was a time when he left a crack cocaine pipe in the phone booth right off the screening room.
Yeah. Oh my God. And he got dismissed from the mansion for several years.
One of Hef's closest mm-hmm. friends. Hef would not tolerate the use of cocaine.
Nope.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, and it didn't matter if you were his closest friend or a celebrity, whatever. If you messed up in any regard in that way, you were out. You were off the list.
You had John Dante's dog that ran up and stuck its tongue up your nose to bust you. So, you just didn't want to do it.
Get away from me. That's funny. Okay. Oh my gosh. This is so good. Thank you so much for sharing that story. We've got to wrap up the show here. We've already been talking for an hour and a half, and what an incredible interview. I'm just so grateful, Richard.
You'll just cut me all out.
No, we won't.
Don't do that.
So at the end of the show, Richard, we like to ask our guests two questions. And it's always interesting to hear what everybody...
Are there prizes for the correct answers?
No, there's no correct answer, silly.
Another dresser.
Okay. Oh, good. I need one, too.
Okay, so first question, three words that define Hef to you.
Okay, I'll preface this by saying the following. As I said in what I wrote that you heard me recite, Manly Night on Monday was the best night of all for those of us in the inner circle. The last time we all saw Hugh Hefner was on that Monday night, and he was then getting around in a wheelchair. He had to be effectively carried up the stairs after the film. So this was the last time we were ever going to see Hugh Hefner. And the films were over. Must have been 10:30. And there was a guy there to help him in the wheelchair. And the Hef was backed out of the screening room as we sat there. And this is what he said to us in three words. The last thing we ever heard Hugh Hefner say, love you all.
Oh, what a sweet moment.
It was.
Wow. And that was the last time. Wow.
And in a couple of days, he was gone.
Did you get to? Well, no, you just said that was the last time you saw him. So, like, obviously, you knew that, you know, like he was sick and he was toward the end of his days.
He was failing.
Did you at least get a chance to sit down one-on-one with him and talk to him? Because the second question we always ask everybody is, if you had the opportunity to speak to Hef before he passed or in memoriam, what would you say?
Well, that's really difficult. What would I say? Well, you know, he was a person who did not deal with death very well.
You know,
he wouldn't go see Mary O'Connor in the hospital.
Right.
And you know,
I remember.
You know.
And Joni either. I used to get with Joni. He was not.
Right. I went to see Joni at the Cedar Sinai. I remember.
I got thrown out of Cedars trying to break her out.
What?
I tried to get her out because she wanted to spend her time home with her dogs.
Really? Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. I got kicked out of Cedars.
Oh, God. I don't know what I would say to him. But he did not deal with anyone passing. So you couldn't talk to him about.
No.
He just turned the page. When somebody was gone, he turned the page. What would I say to him? I don't know. One other thing I'll mention, Ann Randall, because Dick Stewart and Ann Randall, when I first got to the Playboy Mansion, when I didn't understand something that was going on or something about Hef, I would always talk to Dick Stewart.
I loved it.
Dick Stewart he knew Hef better than anyone. And he would give me advice. You may know this. There were, when I got there, there were only three reserved seats for dinner, you know, on the weekends, only three reserved seats apart from, of course, Kimberly, of course, was sitting at the other table. So she wasn't at the main table, but at the main table, it was Dick Stewart to Hef's left. On his right was Ray Anthony. And then next to Ray was Mel Torme. And Mel Torme had his stroke and died just about the time that Keith Hefner patched up the disenchantment that the brothers had for a while.
And right.
And so he moved back to L.A. and Keith took Mel's chair. And when Dick Stewart and Ann Randall moved and went to Sun City, Dick said to me, I've talked to Hef and we want you to sit in my chair. So there were only three of us who had a reserve seat for.
I remember your seats.
All that time, it was just, it's really hard to even talk about this.
I know, it is.
I sat at the other end of the table.
It always brings tears to our eyes.
But Ann Randall, she knew Hef better than anyone. And to my surprise, she said, if Hef were alive now, this wouldn't bother him at all. And Dick Stewart told me, he gave me advice. He said, don't ever bring bad news to Hef because he kills the messenger.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know.
But at one point, I said to Hef, you know, I've been told that I shouldn't tell you any bad news. But on two occasions, I did. And the first one, that Hef left Esquire magazine to found Playboy. So he had this fondness for Esquire magazine. So Esquire wanted to do a piece on Hef. So they sent over a writer, and Hef rolled out the red carpet for this guy, wined and dined him, answered all of his questions. He was there on a manly night. He watched what we did and participated. Then he went off and wrote this terrible piece. And he used a phrase. He talked about Heff's, quote, galloping senility. Now, there was nothing senile about Hugh Hefner,
no.
Anything like that. So when the story broke, I told Heff about this. And I said, I'm not supposed to tell you these things, but I think you need to know. And there was another time on David Letterman's show. He told a joke when Mark got Heff on Viagra. And Heff said, it's the greatest recreational drug in the history of mankind. And he was promoting it and everything. So that got into the news. So David Letterman told this joke that brought the house down about Hugh Hefner. When he dies, they won't be able to close the casket. I can't tell jokes, but that's what the joke was, you know, that they won't be able to close the casket because of the Viagra that he used.
Because he was erect from the Viagra.
That's right.
But so, it's hard on the hearing.
You bet it was. That really wrecked his hearing taking that.
I remember.
But anyway, so this joke went over so big that Letterman kept revisiting this material and dining out on it for weeks. And finally, I had to tell Heff, and then he said to me at dinner, you know, you're more concerned about my reputation than I am. And I said, I can't, if I were you, I would get even with these people. I'd fight back. I don't understand why none of this bothers you. He finally explained it for me, though. He said, I don't care what they say about me. What it demonstrates is that I'm still relevant in the popular culture. And
that's right.
And then Ann Randall told me something else that she learned. I don't remember Heff ever saying this to me or hearing him say it to anyone else, but she said Heff would not care when he goes, he's not going to care what happens to Playboy magazine or what anybody says about him. It isn't going to make any difference to him. I just don't understand that.
He lived his life so full.
Well, he lived his
that's
life.
That's what meant everything to him.
He lived his life his way by design. And you may or may not agree with how he lived his life, but he did it his way. He went against the grain always. And he did understand that controversy would breed publicity. And that goes all the way back to the beginning, you know, when the Postal Service came after him initially, and then the FBI and da-da-da-da. You know, this is what we've learned from doing our interviews as well. So that makes sense that he, like, doesn't care. He would remain relevant. So the common answer to that second question from everybody, Richard, and every single guest got tears in their eyes. And for the majority, they said, just thank you. Thank you for including me on this journey. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to be a part of this legacy and history. And I mean, more can you say than that, you know?
You know, that sort of reflects what he would write. You know, he would give us the new issue of Playboy when it came out on Monday, or if there were books about him or licensed products, he'd bring this stuff down like Santa Claus on Monday night and distribute this stuff. And when he would sign these books for us, it would usually be a sentiment like, you know, for Mel or Ray or whoever it was, or Kevin, who shared the dream, who dreamed the dream with me, something like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, he's...
All right.
I have a Christmas ornament of a trading card he signed to me, because he doesn't sign them. And he signed one to me, and it's in a pearl little thing, and it hangs on my Christmas tree every year.
Yeah.
Of him.
Thank you again. What a incredible interview and incredible insight. And again, we are just so grateful that we have this platform. And most of all, reuniting with our Playboy family, Richard, has just been amazing and Food for the Soul. And, you know, collectively as a whole, you know, we have the opportunity to share with the world, you know, the truth, our truth. And not everybody's going to, you know, accept it, believe it, whatever. But I know that, you know, if we
if I say 2 + 4 = 6 and someone argues with me and says, no, it's 9. What are we to do? There's nothing
that you can do. So we can just share with the world the incredible, profoundly important history of this man who changed society and culture as a whole. We love him. We miss him. And we are so grateful for what he did, not only for us personally, but for the world. I'm Echo.
And I'm Kathy.
And this is
The Bunny Chronicle.
Yeah, yeah. All right. We'll see you guys next week. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your love. Keep listening. Follow us. Rate our show. We have so many incredible guests coming up. Kathy, thank you so much for filling in as our guest host. And Kathy will be on the show a lot. You can count on that. So
I'm in and out. In and out.
We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.